On this episode of Skeptico,
scientists would love to tear down a paradigm.
Oh, yeah, science of course.
Science, don't laugh at this. Science is not a religion. Scientists would love to tear down a big name and say, no, that theory is incorrect, this is incorrect. They might even get a big prize for that. They certainly get advancement in their career. This is not, science is a different thing. I don't think you have a good impression of science. You're doing this broadcast, but to tell me that this is published in peer-reviewed journals, well, I'd like to know. If such a major observation goes contra to so many other things, is it published in Nature? In Science?
George, because this is, I have 300 episodes of why. I think you are an incredibly generous spirit that defies your philosophical rantings about atheism. You are not an atheist in your soul, George, and it comes through loud and clear. But you're just are not well informed about the science that contradicts this idea that we are these biological robots in a meaningless world.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and for some time now, I've had this take on all comers spirit attitude with regard to materialist science, especially neuroscientists. So when Jimmy, a friend of the Skeptico show and one of the scouts out there scouting out people who might be willing to engage in this topic, suggested today's guest, Dr. George Paxinos, I was like, sure, he's an acclaimed neuroscientist. His work, which is really quite extraordinary, he's developed this atlas, if you will, for mapping the brain function of experimental animals, and which is useful developing medicines or treatments or something like that. So it's obviously really important work. Now, the actual debate between George and I, and we did set it up as a debate, he had full knowledge of everything I was going to ask him, and I even previewed some of the clips I was going to send him beforehand. But the debate turned out to be more of a trip down memory lane for myself and probably for many of you Skeptico listeners who have tried to walk people along the path from the old paradigm of mind equals brain to whatever lies beyond. Enough said. Here's the interview. Today we're joined by acclaimed neuroscientist Professor George Paxinos from the University of New South Wales, Australia, where he's both a highly regarded academic, having published more than 45 books on the structure of the brain and neuroscience, as well as a very highly respected neuroscience researcher who's striving to make our lives better by understanding the human brain. Dr. Paxinos, it's quite an honor to have you on. Thank you for joining me on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex. May I start with a quote from Mark Twain? I always get embarrassed when they introduce me. They never say enough.
I love Mark Twain quotes, and I think that that's very fitting in this case because anyone who would look at your bio would see that your accomplishments are many, and you're really to be highly respected for that. I mean, a life in science is difficult, even if it's mainstream science, or even more difficult with some of the people we talk to who venture outside of the mainstream. But it's still a difficult life, and it's a life of service and trying to make life better.
Yeah,
so you'd be commended
right.
for that.
I mean, it has been fun, and scientists are usually just following their curiosity, so there is inherent pleasure in that. And they are not out there to solve the world's problems. They really there to find something, some relation in nature. That's what actually Flory said, who discovered the penicillin, and who did more than him for humanity. And yet even he said that it was an academic question that he was asking, and the suffering humanity was not in his mind. It was pleasant that his work was of help, but it wasn't the reason he did it. So we are not all that altruistic.
That is a wonderful, wonderful lead-in to what we're going to talk about, because I think that gets at, in many ways, gets at the heart of what's really going on and whether we really do understand even ourselves, our motivations and the larger way in which we fit into this world and who we are and what this world is all about. So let me just tell listeners that we're going to do something a little bit different, George, because you're not here to sell any of your recent books, although I'm sure if folks want to go and check out your books, most of them are academic titles. Do you have any titles that are more for the general population? I don't really know the answer to that, so I apologize. But tell
There is one, though. There is a problem. It's in Greek. And for most people, that's Greek to me. It's a novel that deals with some of the issues that you are concerned with. Free will, nature, nurture, as well as the environment and religion. I hope it will be published in English. Right now it's in the hands of an agent. It is called In His Image, and it refers to, it rather asks the question, what would someone with the genetic endowment of Christ say about the state of the environment today, and the issues of free will, determinism, and what forms our personality, do we have any freedom at all, come into this. And it is understandable by lay people. Hopefully it'll be published in English.
Wow. I mean, right off the bat, I have to digress a minute a little bit because I'm surprised. Are you a believer in Jesus Christ, as in the religious figure?
Thank you for asking that. I am an admirer of Christ as a man, as a human being. I don't have any room for metaphysics.
Okay, good. I mean, highly question the historicity of the figure Jesus is portrayed in the Bible. I don't know that there ever was such an individual exactly like that, and I really question the source and interpretation of that book. But hey, that's an aside. We can talk about that another time. I just wanted to tell people that, you know, what we're going to try and do today, I think, is you were kind enough to join me in what really amounts to somewhat of a debate, a friendly debate discussion about some of these issues surrounding the topics that we talk about so much here on Skeptico, and that is consciousness and scientific materialism, which goes hand in hand, I think, with the fundamental assumption made by neuroscience. And your name and your work was brought to my attention by a listener who sent me this little article, this piece that you wrote titled Why Psychology Lost Its Soul, Everything Comes from the Brain, in which you kind of call to task psychologists for kind of stepping gingerly around this issue of soul and soulfulness, and you're saying, look, there's no such thing. We are brain-based, brain-first beings, and we should just kind of accept that. So is that kind of our starting point here, or your starting point in this discussion?
You've said it, and I think that we actually can be better people, can understand the others better, can forgive better. You mentioned Christ. And he was the first one that I know who said something that neuroscience says today, that there's no freedom, there is no dignity, there's just genes that are sculpted by experience. And you can't blame your genes, and you can't blame that you were born in the US or in Afghanistan. And Jesus said, for those who crucified him, that they don't know what they're doing. He forgave them. That is, he understood that the actions of humans are based on only, he wouldn't have known of the genes, but on the environment that produced them, that shaped them. And that's what neuroscience says today, that the behavior is determined by two factors, and only two factors, none other, which are the genetic endowment that we get from our parents, and we have no option, no choice what parent would to select, and the environmental influence on that genetic endowment, and you were didn't choose to be born in the United States to whatever religious parents or non-religious parents, it was thrust upon you. You have no choice, and therefore you cannot be blamed. This can result in a far gentler society, and I can go into that if you like. Once you understand that, you can forgive people.
Okay, I don't agree with much of that, but what I thought we might center this discussion around are some quotes that I've sent you from some former guests that I think frame up this discussion in a slightly different way. And, you know, the first one I was going to play for our audience and for you is from UCLA research psychiatrist and fellow brains researcher, someone who's very much into brain research and was really did some pioneering work with brain imaging in order to understand and help people overcome OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. That is Dr. Jeffrey Swartz from University of California, Los Angeles, who is, you know, to his credit, one of the world recognized leaders in neuroplasticity. Let me play for you the quote that he has that I think gets to, in a way, what you were saying.
They are committed ideologically to the notion that everything is the brain. So you get into this profound mismatch. And
the mismatch is that it's self-evident to any person who has any kind of experience with meditation or even just basic contemplation that this is going on, and yet they're confronted with an academic explanation that is a stone wall in denying any of it. That's a reasonable
summary of the situation.
What Dr. Swartz is alluding to, and I think you kind of reframed it in your retelling of the Jesus story, because Jesus wasn't saying any of that. Jesus was saying that we are not just our body. Jesus is coming completely from the understanding that we are more than our brain. When Jesus is saying that, he is reflecting the same thing that almost every wisdom tradition throughout time has said. So when I hear Dr. Swartz talk about the profound mismatch, I think what he's talking about, George, is that 90% of people, no matter how you ask the question, whether you ask the question, do you believe in God? Whether you ask the question, do you believe in a higher power? Do you have free will? Do you believe everything is predetermined? More than 90% of people have this experience that they are more, that there is something more. And these great books like the Bible, if you want to call that a great book, reflect that. So I just don't understand how you can turn that around and say that it was some kind of treatise for neuroscience. It was completely under the understanding that we are more than these biological robots, right?
You can understand. Christ understood the behavior of those who crucified him. He understood that they would have been on his side if only they had been exposed to his teachings and not to the Pharisees' teachings, to some other teachings. Now, if you take the view that it's the brain and only, and that there's nothing metaphysical, then you don't blame the soul for the autistic child that is misbehaving. It is cruel, Alex, to blame the soul of a little child rather than a misfiring of neurons, misconnection of neurons, a developmental error in the formation of the brain of the child. This, again, will become, you become you can forgive easier somebody who left you, let's say you're a scorned lover, your girlfriend left you, right? The chances are more than 50% that you will interfere with her at her house, at her work, at her Facebook page, at her Twitter account, at the internet in general. And you might even hurt her. You might even kill her. I'm telling you, if you understand that she had no more capacity to keep loving you when she lost that love, then you are able to forget her and not love her anymore. Then you can forgive her and say, that's fine. She dropped me. She doesn't love me. That's it. And you can become gentler in your own behavior and understand the behavior of the people in Afghanistan when they are told that this woman burned the Quran and the men chase her to stone her to death. You can understand them. That's how the environment, that's what produced. And if you were born in Afghanistan and I were born in Afghanistan, likely we will be stoning that woman too. But we were born in a different environment and we do not stone a woman who burned the Bible. So you can understand behavior better if you follow this paradigm rather than the metaphysical paradigm that you are following.
I mean, George, I'm kind of dumbstruck because your philosophical humanitarian sentiments are awesome for an atheist. But that's why I like to keep bringing things back to science, because I think it kind of clears the table of a lot of flowery talk that we could agree on. Do you understand Dr. Schwartz's research? Dr. Schwartz is a brain scientist like you are. And what he sought to do is find out whether thinking about thinking, that is mindfulness, which isn't in one of your two things that you said creates all our experience. Thinking about thinking, whether that affects the structure of the human brain. And he found conclusively that it does. So that's why he's one of the worldwide authorities on neuroplasticity, because he found that mindfulness does affect the structure of the brain. So at the very least, now we have a question of the chicken and the egg. I mean, if you think the brain creates everything and thoughts create the brain, well, then what came first, thoughts or the brain?
We'll come to that, Alex. But firstly, I need to correct you on something. You said I am altruistic or humanitarian, whatever you mentioned there, for an atheist. That is really below the belt. That's just not correct, because I'll answer.
Why?
Just wait. Because atheists can contribute to the society altruistically as well as anybody else. In fact, I know of one study where the children of, you might be aware of this, of Christians, the children of Muslims, and the children of atheists, they were rated on the altruism spectrum.
But why would we want to compare with these phony baloney religions? I mean, Christianity, Islam, I mean, these are not religious traditions that we hold up as the pillars of high thought. No, these are people that have been in many ways manipulated and controlled into a certain way of thinking in the same way that atheists have. That's why we got to kind of clear the table of all that and try and sort it out through the best we can through the science that we have. Who cares about the study of whether, you know, Mormons or Scientologists or atheists are, you know, more loving in some situations. I don't care about that.
I was not so bad. I have to refute that, Alex, and you have to allow me the time. And I'll tell you this. The Christians and the Muslims constitute something like maybe 60%, maybe more, I don't know, of the population. And therefore, I'm comparing the children of atheists with the children, or at least that study compared the children of atheists with the children of people who have faith in these faiths, all right? And they found that the children of atheists actually were scored better on compassion and altruism than the other children. I am not claiming moral superiority for the atheists. I am just taking umbrage to your statement that for an atheist. Now, Alex, you need to take that back.
I take it back in the sense that you've called me on it, George, but I don't take it back in the sense that I intended it, which is that it is philosophically incoherent to even suggest that there is a moral scale for someone who believes that they're a biological robot and life has no meaning. If life, you know, the famous French philosopher summed it up best. He said there's only one philosophical question: suicide. If you don't think life has meaning, if you don't think you have free will, then why would anyone perpetuate this ridiculous farce that they found themselves in? This is, I think, the inherent contradiction in atheism, and especially in humanitarian atheism. That's why I say, clear off all that bullshit and let's look at the science to find out if the assumption that atheists make, which is the neuroscience premise that you are nothing more than your brain, that you are a biological robot, let's examine whether the evidence stands up to that. And if it doesn't, then you have to move on. If it does, then I'm fine with all the flowery philosophical stuff.
Do not feel love for their children, even though they believe that there's nothing in terms of metaphysical, or that we have no purpose on the planet than whatever biology produced of us. You mean they have no love for their children? I have news for you, for their parents too, and for their girlfriends and for their boyfriends.
I think the only honest philosophical argument from the atheist camp in that comes from Dr. Daniel Dennett, even though I think he's somewhat of a nitwit, when he said consciousness is an illusion. That is your position, I think, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying our sense that we have a conscious experience, that we have free will, that we have an independent experience, you're saying that is an illusion created by our brain, are you not? Are you saying something
listen
different?
Listen to what I'm saying. I'm saying in that article that you read that psychology lost its soul, that is, the soul is surplus to requirements. Souls are superfluous as it concerns the understanding and the modification of human behavior or animal behavior. That is what I'm saying. Now, you are telling me to solve the puzzle of consciousness. Well, I certainly can't, and science can't solve everything, can solve some things. Certainly, we haven't, maybe we'll agree with this, we haven't made progress in cosmology or whatever else by opening the Holy Scriptures. We've made progress slowly, often with errors, by the scientific method. I am not claiming that I will answer you all your questions, but I certainly can say that a psychologist does not need to evoke the concept of the soul to understand and modify behavior such as obsessive-compulsive disorders, prevent accidents, whatever. They work on the basis that they have in front of them a biological organ, a human with a brain.
Okay, I tell you what, there's a lot more we could go on about this issue, but maybe let's try and approach it from a different angle. A second clip I would try and play for you, if you will. And you've been spirited debate. I love where you're coming from. I'm somewhat surprised, again, for the reasons I mentioned, but it's awesome. So let me play for you philosopher Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, who I sent you this clip as well, but let me play it for our audience, who was probably well aware of Bernardo here. So let me play this.
You see, we always start from the fact that we are conscious. Consciousness is the only carrier of reality and existence that we can know. Everything else is abstraction, are inferences we make from consciousness. But our culture is driven by this notion that the real reality is outside consciousness. It's a material universe fundamentally independent of consciousness. And that our inner lives, our subjective experiences, arise from specific arrangements of material in this abstract world outside mind. That's the philosophy of materialism, which underlies most academic work, underlies most of science as you know it today, but also underlies the value system of our culture, our economic system. For instance, if matter is the only real reality, consciousness being just a kind of transient, temporary side effect, then what meaning can there be to life but to accumulate material goods?
Okay, I tell you what, before I say anything, let me give you a chance to comment on Bernardo's thoughts
Firstly, what meaning can there be to life except acquire material goods? How does he say, how can you conclude that the only meaning, the only meaning to life for a person who doesn't believe in souls and ghosts is to acquire material goods. I get pleasure when I take my kid on the swing, my grandchild on the swing. Why is he saying that I don't have that pleasure? Because I believe that we have no purpose in life. If you want to believe that your purpose in life is to serve God or to do something else, go ahead and believe it. I think there's no God. There's no evidence for God for me. I can't prove that science will never be able to prove that, or that science will never be able to prove that there's no soul. Simply that you don't need it. That's what I'm arguing, Alex. But the other issue about events outside the material world, I can tell you this, that if I, assuming that you are right now in good spirits, I give you tetrabenazine, there's a chance that you will fall into depression because of this drug that depletes serotonin. On the other hand, if you are depressed, as many people become depressed, virtually every one of us will become depressed at some point in life, if we are given one of the antidepressants, there's a good chance that we'll recover sooner than if we were left on our own devices. Now, these drugs act on serotonin and some other neurotransmitters in the brain. They don't act on the soul.
Right. But George, just to clarify, no one is arguing the close relationship between the mind and the brain, between our internal conscious experience and the functioning, either properly or improperly, of our brain. That's not at issue. The analogy that many people use is our brain really the generator of consciousness, or is it the vehicle through which consciousness flows? Is it like a TV set where consciousness is somehow everywhere and the brain is immersed in consciousness? And both worldviews fit with the explanation that you gave. I think what Bernardo's frustration is, and it's my frustration, and that I don't know if you have thought about this much, but that neuroscience's premise is materialism. Brain generates mind. It's not a conclusion. It's not a scientific conclusion.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A premise. It's a starting point. And it needs to... Well, it's not. That's the point. It's consistent as long as we ignore all the data
I have some data that I don't know if you have considered. These data come from the split brain preparations, where consciousness can be divided in two, as the brain is divided in two, virtually two. That is not exactly, because there are other connections below the corpus callosum, but principally. The split brain preparations, and I don't know if you have interviewed Gazzaniga, who did work with Sperry and Ledoux. They had an article, which is referred to actually in my article in The Conversation that you refer to, where you can read that you can see that there is a way, artificial way, of course, of dividing consciousness in the person into, colloquially speaking. That is, if you cut the major highway connection between the two hemispheres, which is the corpus callosum, as they did to alleviate epilepsy back in the 60s, some of the patients are still alive, then you can present stimuli to one hemisphere, to one visual field that is not crossed over because it cannot cross with the corpus callosum, you see. And you can test the two hemispheres separately and expose them to different experiences. And in that case, you can have different responses from the two hemispheres. There was one occasion, I think, where a man was pulling his wife with one hand and pushing her away with the other hand. So just consider that consciousness is also a physical thing. And you can divide it in two.
Well, again, a premise, not a conclusion by experimentation, but a premise, a starting point, a worldview that's very dogmatically held by many. I mean, on this show, George, one of the reasons we've investigated near-death experience science so thoroughly is because it really kind of cuts to the chase on all this stuff, on all the studies that you've mentioned and many other that neuroscientists like to point to, you can have other people like Jeffrey Schwartz and Dr. Mario Beauregard and many other really smart people I've had on the show point to studies that suggest otherwise, just like the placebo effect and all the mind-brain or all the mind-body effects point otherwise. But I'm digressing because really near-death experience science clears up all
of
this.
Alex, can I just say, I suggest that you read the Ledoux and Gazzaniga article, and it is not an assumption. It is data. You might quarrel with the data and say that it's not well controlled or whatever. That's possible. They might be wrong. But that is not assumption. That is, now we're talking about data.
Right. Data that doesn't refute the idea that the brain is immersed in a consciousness field and that somehow its interaction that we don't totally understand inside of that consciousness field is producing these varied effects. So in the same way that you could have your TV in there and we could mess with the circuitry and get all sorts of different things coming out of your TV, and then we could say, gee, that TV generates all kinds of different content based on how we mess with the circuitry, and then we would find out later, well, it really is dependent on the signal that's coming in to the TV, not just to the circuitry of the TV alone. So that research that you're referring to is great as a body of research for understanding the relationship between the brain and consciousness, but it doesn't get at the fundamental question of what is the nature of consciousness? When does consciousness begin? When does consciousness end? What is necessary and sufficient to cause consciousness? Are other beings, are other animals conscious? None of these things are understood by neuroscience. They're just assumed. Tell me which one of those is understood. Tell me, go ahead, George, which one of those do we know?
Refer to consciousness being as something, again, not a good definition, but at least you can get an idea of it, something that we have more of when we're engaged in conversation, when someone is listening to someone, less of when we're about to sleep, less of when we're embryos, less of when we're dementing, and animals and systems.
That's complete nonsense, right? When does consciousness begin? At what day does it begin in the embryo?
But it's degrees. We have no idea.
They're just making it up, George. They're just blowing smoke.
Don't use epithets so readily. You have to consider that they are degrees. It's not bimodal. Consciousness, non-consciousness. And I can tell you this, the chimpanzee has consciousness. They can use a mirror and remove something that you placed on their head. They understand it's themselves they're looking at. I'm not sure about the rat. Rat's a good model for human behavior many times. That's why many psychologists are studying the rat. So don't dismiss it as a bimodal thing, all right?
Then let me return to near-death experience because I think it clarifies this quite convincingly, because now we have patients in hospital under well-understood medical conditions. What's studied most because of that is cardiac arrest, because we really understand the physiology of someone after they've suffered cardiac arrest. So there's near-death experience occurs in many different ways, you know, drowning, even if someone's just flying in a plane and the plane's going to crash, they can have a near-death experience. But the one that's studied most scientifically by cardiologists many times, or, you know, I just talked to a radiation oncologist who's probably studied more than any, is in the cardiac arrest ward, because we know so clearly what happens to the brain after cardiac arrest. That is that there is no detectable brain function. We don't have any model for how memories or conscious experience can be formed in a severely compromised brain after cardiac arrest. Yet when we look at these patients, they clearly have not just conscious experiences, but profound conscious experiences, the most profound experiences they've ever had in their life. They report being outside of their body in a way that we can't possibly be explained. When they're reviewed medically, 96% of those people are able to confirm the experiences they have being outside of their body as true. Over and over and over again, we have this huge amount of data that people in the materialist camp and the neuroscientist camp very carefully step aside from, because there's really no medical explanation for it in the model that we have that the mind is generated by the brain. So is that anything you've looked into?
The poor cardiac surgeons, they did a disservice to this discipline by heart transplants. They showed that the love or whatever that was attributed to the heart has nothing to do with the heart. The heart of your wife in a heart transplant, Alex, I will not fall in love with you. So I just wanted to make that clear that the heart has nothing to do with emotions, since you mentioned it. But now going to the real question about the brain does not die in heart transplants. If the neurons die, then that's it. There's no way of you getting resurrected. But now, I did have a near-death experience reported to me by an anesthetist who said that this fellow that was nearly lost this patient, but then he came back and he said, "I really went to paradise," he said, "and I saw what is in there. 1,000 red Ferraris." Are you still there?
Yes, 1,000 red Ferraris.
That's right.
That's what he saw.
I suspect, Alex.
Is that somehow, is that kind of anecdotal kind of story somehow supposed to be, I mean, you realize that there's been hundreds of peer-reviewed studies on near-death experience science published, so you know, without regard to the story that you heard from your friend, there's a large body of research here. It's not just stories passed among surgeons
in
the ward there.
I'm prepared to hear any hallucination that the person might have had in such things. But to tell me that he or she went to another world and saw what's there, well, that I have to be skeptical about. You seem to be skeptical.
No, you don't have to be skeptical. I hate when folks say that. All you have to do is be open-minded, a good scientist. You just investigate, and then you come to the conclusion that you come to. I'll tell you the study that people who listen to this show are tired of hearing about this study, but for folks like you who are uninitiated with near-death experience science, it's kind of one of the easiest ones to wrap your arms around. It's been replicated twice, at least, I think, three or four times, but the two people I know is Dr. Janice Holden at the University of North Texas and Dr. Penny Sartori in the UK, I forget which university it was in. They did a rather simple experiment. They went into a cardiac arrest ward and they talked to these subjects before they experienced a cardiac arrest, and they asked if they would participate in this study, and they did. Unfortunately, the people in the study had a cardiac arrest, and they went to the people after they had a cardiac arrest and they asked them to report in detail their resuscitation. So, as you know, that's not like the movies. It doesn't begin 10 seconds after you have a cardiac arrest. It begins 1 to 2 minutes, usually around 2 minutes after you've had a cardiac arrest, resuscitation begins. So, there is no, from a neuroscience standpoint, there's no thing happening in the brain. It is flatlined. There is no electrical activity after 2 minutes of being deprived of your heart. So you have two groups. Now, your cardiac arrest patients are divided into two groups. One group that says, "I had a near-death experience and I saw my resuscitation." And the other group said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I was dead and now I'm back." Well, as it turns out, the group that had the near-death experience and claimed to see their resuscitation was dramatically better at reporting the details of their resuscitation and things that were clearly outside of their vision, outside of the immediate room, outside below their table and all the rest of this. So this is scientific work published in a peer-reviewed journal that demonstrates an unexplainable ability of people to have conscious experiences, have memories formed at a time when they didn't have a brain. So it just shatters the whole notion that we can dance around and talk about all these other people, but that's really the simplest way to kind of get to it is through that kind of science.
They were able to see things that were under the table that were not in their view, somehow a spirit of theirs wandered around and went under the table and saw them. Is that what you mean?
We don't have to hypothesize a spirit. This is a survey. This is a medical survey. We go in and we ask them to report details of their resuscitation. You know, what happened next? Well, they wheeled in this cart. What color were the paddles? How many people wheeled it in? What did they do? What did they do next? So people are recalling the resuscitation. People who don't have a near-death experience just go, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any memories of that. People who have a near-death experience are able to report in detail, in an accurate way, things that are verifiable about what happened during their resuscitation. This is just one of, many dozens, hundreds of near-death experience science that's published in peer-reviewed journals that a lot of people just ignore because it's uncomfortable. It breaks the paradigm this mind.
Scientists would love to tear down a paradigm. Science is not
a religion. Oh, I know. Of course.
Science, don't laugh at this. Science is not a religion. Scientists would love to tear down a big name and say, no, that theory is incorrect. This is incorrect. They might even get a big prize for that. They certainly get advancement in their career. This is not, science is a different thing. I don't think you have a good impression of science. You're doing this broadcast, but to tell me that this is published in peer-reviewed journals, well, I'd like to know if such a major observation goes contra to so many other things, is it published in Nature? In Science? Why are you laughing?
George, because this is, I have 300 episodes of why. I have 300 episodes answering the question why. I think you are in an incredibly generous spirit that defies your philosophical rantings about atheism. You are not an atheist in your soul, George, and it comes through loud and clear. But you are not well informed about the science that contradicts this idea that we are these biological robots.
Maybe you're more generous to me than I deserve. But certainly, to save your soul on the basis of these experiences, which can be interpreted in a different way, and from what you told me, it was not published in major magazines such as Nature or Science.
Yeah, Nature, right? As Nature.
I know. Right. You are. Nature is where.
Well, I tell you what, the probably the most well-known near-death experience science research was published in The Lancet. How does that do? One of the top two medical journals in the world, The Lancet,
Lancet,
okay?
It's a good journal, and
but it's not Nature.
I'm not saying that. But you can get a scientific study of near-death experiences. Of course you can get a scientific study of it. I don't know what they published there. But to say that somebody was able to see underneath the table, though there was no way of seeing it except if there was a floating eye underneath and over the table, I would like to see the study, to see the controls that they used. Any scientist can make a mistake. In fact, 1 in 20 of the articles that we read in Nature and Science are wrong because of the statistical approach that we use. But what I really want to leave you with is that you don't need to hypothesize these souls or the metaphysics to understand behavior. And you can be as happy and as altruistic as any other person next to you, I would argue perhaps more, if you actually understand who we are, that we are a branch of the primates. The closest relative to us is the chimpanzee, and the chimpanzee's closest relative is not the gorilla, it is us. So we are one of those creatures. And we have dazzled ourselves with TVs, etc., but for hundreds of thousands of years, with the same intellectual capacity, we are not much different from the other primates, but we managed to step on each other's shoulders and produce science and technology, which today, by the way, threatens existence. if you look at it, I am not idolizing the brain. I think it's a limited organ that imposes intellectual, motivational, and emotional constraints on us, not much different from that on the chimpanzee. And you might even notice that even in yourself, when you are driving on the road and somebody cuts ahead of you, endangering you, and taking your right of way, how angry you might get for that. So it's not that I idolize the brain. It's just that believe in ghosts and near-death experiences, well, in the lack of strong evidence is also not according to the title of your program, skeptical.
Skeptical from skepticos, right? From those philosophers who always never came to a conclusion, but always kept asking questions. George, you've been a part of some very important research, brain research, and you started with animals, but it's also, you've also looked at the human brain. What would people be most interested in terms of your career, what you've discovered, if you could just kind of give some quick highlights on some of the main discoveries you were a part of.
Our work assists scientists to navigate seamlessly between the brain of humans and experimental animals. So someone inspired by human considerations, such as epilepsy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, may produce an animal model of a disease, and there are either genetic models or behavioral. You can produce anxiety in a rat. If you shock them enough times in a chamber, they will be anxious next time you place them there. And you can then look at anxiolytic drugs to see what might assist them, or other interventions such as flooding, put them in there without a shock. So they study models in the of disease in the experimental animals, and then they want to relate their observations back to the humans, and we provide them with the atlases to investigate the brain and to actually relate their observations, to navigate between the brains. And in the case of our human brain atlases, they can also use the neurosurgeons use them in surgery theaters when they want to stimulate the brain for treatment of Parkinson's, for example. There is some efficacious treatment for some people. Now, the thing that excites us really most is that we find an area in the brain that was not known before to science. And we found such areas in the mammalian brain, 91 areas we found. We gave them names because you have a chance to name something if you identify it. And yeah, that is the most pleasant thing. My colleague Charles Watson, who plays the saxophone, when we are lucky and we find a nucleus, we stop the work and we play the saxophone.
Awesome. So what you and Dr. Watson are kind of best known for is, again, that's kind of an interesting term, of this atlas, this mapping system for research scientists to make the connection between experimental animals and the human brain, right? So that sounds like vital work in terms of bringing on new treatments, new therapies, new drugs.
It is of help to those who, that is, most people who study the brain in relation to these diseases need our atlases to navigate, to find where they are, either if you consider the brain postmortem or if they have an image of the brain in the scan, the PET scan, the MRI. They need like a street directory, much like on a map of the US, you can place the railway lines, forested areas, population centers. So on a map of the brain, you can place the kind of neurons you get, the kind of neurotransmitters you have, receptors, enzymes, or the function, what function that area has, what connections it has. And that helps people formulate hypotheses about normal and abnormal human function.
Great, great. Well, it sounds like very important work, and you're to be commended for it. And I certainly do appreciate you joining me. I think it was a very spirited debate. I hope folks got a lot out of it. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what you bring to it. As I say, I wish I could muster up some more anger at what you're saying, but I really can't, because you have such a wonderful way of and a positive message about conveying these ideas and a positive worldview. So it's been a real delight talking to you. Our guest has been Dr. George Paxinos. Thank you again for joining me on Skeptico. Thanks again to Dr. Paxinos for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I tee up from this interview is one of the big ones. Has the paradigm shifted? You know, it's become almost an assumption in this show, because we get into this echo chamber and we believe that we see this growing trend pointing towards the end of materialism, and that we see this advancement of near-death experience science or mediumship research or whatever. And then we talk to George. So is this just a matter of a changing of the guard? George is at the end of his career and people who are replacing him coming in have this new paradigm perspective. Is that what we're seeing? Or are we deluding ourselves about the rate of change? So let me know your thoughts on that. Either way, the place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. Leave a comment there, jump over to the forum, connect with me on Facebook, however you do it. Just let me know what you think of the show, and let me know what you think of this interview with George. Now, you may have noticed there wasn't a transcript for this show, and that's because I was really just trying to crank this out at the end, and I didn't think there was a lot of really new material here, just a rehashing of a lot of stuff we've talked about in the past. So in the interest of time, I pushed it out without the transcript, but of course, you can expect those on future episodes of Skeptico, of which I have many in the hopper and some really, really good ones I think you will enjoy. Please stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.